Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. On Friday, the House passed the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. If the Senate goes along, it would be the most sweeping overhaul of the financial regulatory system in the U.S. since the 1930s. Joining me in the studio to talk about what the new rules mean for business and consumers, Michael Greenberger. He's professor of law at the University of Maryland. Travis Plunkett. He's legislative director for the Consumer Federation of America. And Philip Swagel. He's a professor at the Georgetown University School of Business. Do join us. Questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Michael Greenberger, what is the purpose of this meeting at the White House this morning?
Well, the economy, Main Street economy, is suffering terribly because even though the banks, big banks, the five big banks, have been rescued and are doing perfectly fine, they are not extending credit to smaller businesses and not allowing homeowners to refinance, even though interest rates are very low. The failure of businesses to get credit is a real drag on the economy. We're going to have a very hard time meaningfully coming out of the recession unless small business is able to borrow money to do what it does best, which is hire people.
So he's in there to give them a pep talk.
Unfortunately, it amounts to a pep talk. He sort of got his hat in his hand saying, we help you. Can you please now help us?
Well, now, speaking of helping you and now helping us, apparently Citigroup has reached an agreement to repay some of those bailouts. Funds, Travis Plunkett.
Yes, they've announced that they're going to try and repay on an expedited basis, sooner than they were expected to, the remaining so-called TARP funds, government bailout funds, very soon.
Interesting, Philip Swagel, that these companies are trying to pay back very quickly. How come?
I think many banks have discovered that having the government as a counterparty, having the government in your business, is not a good way to do business.
Why not?
Well, I think they can look at GM and Chrysler, where GM tries to make business decisions and members of Congress tell them, no, don't do that. Or Fannie and Freddie try to make business decisions and the government tells them, no, you have to intentionally lose money to execute our program. And banks, they're not in it for that.
Isn't it also the idea that executive pay is restricted under U.S. regulations where the banks are concerned?
As the banks that took extraordinary assistance from the government have more restrictions on executive compensation. Most of the banks have pretty moderate restrictions, and yet they're also paying back. So I suspect it's more than just exec comp. Exec comp is too easy to
point to. You know, it's fascinating to me that these banks were in such dire need, and yet they're pretty quickly paying things back. Why is that, Travis?
Well, their Wall Street operations right now are quite profitable. So they're not making a whole lot, as we've heard from Dr. Greenberger, they're not doing a lot of lending, and they're not making a great deal from their lending. And some of the previous mistakes they've made regarding their lending are hurting their bottom line. But their Wall Street operations are, right now, quite profitable.
So give us an overview, Michael Greenberger, of what's in this House legislation.
Well, it's a very comprehensive piece of legislation, and it touches on many different areas of malpractices that many people believe led to the meltdown. One of the big parts of it is a Consumer Finance Protection Agency, which in its best intent is designed to protect people against being taken advantage of in day-to-day business activities by credit card companies and others, and mortgage brokers. There are many exemptions to it, which cause people some people problems. Also, it creates and gives the government the power to be a systemic regulator. When companies become endangered by being too big to fail, there are actions the federal government can take either to protect them against failure or, in the case of failure, wind them down. Most importantly for me is the regulation of what are called over-the-counter derivatives. Mm. Those are the tricky, complex, explosive derivatives. Most people now know them as credit default swaps, which many people believe were the direct cause of the meltdown. And there are corrective measures there. For every corrective measure, there was a blunting aspect to it. Wall Street and corporate 500 corporations led by the Chamber of Commerce got a lot of little goodies in here that didn't make this bill as strong as I would have liked to have seen it. But on the whole, I think it is a helpful bill.
Travis Plunkett, tell us about this new agency to protect consumers.
This is a significant step forward, Diane. We saw massive failure in the regulation of consumer credit. We all know about the predatory subprime mortgage problem, which helped trigger the housing crisis and then the economic crisis. But there were also very big failures in other areas. You on your show have talked about credit cards and credit card abuses by credit card lenders, so-called overdraft loans. These are the loans that banks often extend with no knowledge on the part of the borrower if they accidentally overdraw their account. You can end up paying $35, $40 for a $4 cup of coffee. There were numerous failures by the existing regulators to rein in abusive, deceptive lending. So the idea here is that we need to concentrate in one agency, actually take power away from the 7+ federal agencies who, in theory, are supposed to look at protecting consumers, put it all in one agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and make them accountable for protecting consumers from these abuses, which not only hurt millions of families, but also, in the long run, hurt the economy.
So
it's a dramatic change from the current structure.
So, Philip Swigel, how has the financial industry come to view this legislation?
I think with, you know, very much a mixed view. I think people understand that there were problems and that you need to have reform. And so there's no doubt about the need for reform. The question is that financial innovation is fundamentally good for Americans. It's good for wealthy Americans. It's also good for low-income Americans. And it's difficult to winnow out just the bad without also getting rid of some of the good. And I think that's where the banking industry, I suspect, is coming from, that they're saying, you know, look, we understand we need to change, and we're not going to make the same mistakes again, but we're not going to have another subprime meltdown based on the kind of lending that we had over the last few years. Those loans are no longer being made. But that also means that many low-income Americans will not have as good an opportunity to get into a home. And, you know, again, you're going to protect some people, but some people will be harmed as a result. And it's a balancing act.
Travis.
Diane, unfortunately, we saw a lot of negative innovation in the credit marketplace, exploding adjustable rate mortgage loans, credit card interest rates that credit card companies can increase for no reason or any reason. Their innovation is not always positive, and there were serious problems in the marketplace that led to exactly the problems we're talking about. Credit had dried up. Lower income people and people with lower credit worthiness weren't getting access to credit. All this occurred because of bad regulation. The Consumer Financial Protection Agency is going to lead to more transparency, more knowledge about what kind of credit is being offered. It's going to protect people from bad lending, from abusive and deceptive loans. It will actually improve the lending situation and lead to the kind of level playing field for positive innovation that Philip is talking about.
Philip.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I just worry that the more you clamp down on credit, low-income people who don't have access to credit, say to credit cards, will go to payday lenders, and then everyone will be worse off. That's what I worry about.
I would just note that this agency will have authority over payday lenders, and our great hope is that there will be no place to hide, no bad place for lenders to go in terms of offering high-cost abusive loans. The idea is a level playing field for all different types of loans offered by non-banks like payday lenders and banks as well.
Michael Greenberger, are you happy with this portion?
I'm happy with this portion. I'm happy with the bill as a whole. I would just say in terms of financial innovation brought us to our knees. The so-called financial innovation of credit default swaps, AIG being the poster child, not the only problem, but the poster child problem, where AIG issued tens of billions of dollars of credit default swaps, which essentially insured, they were insurance policies. People paid premiums. They said, we're making risky bets on the question of whether people without good credit will pay their subprime mortgages. The thesis for not worrying about those bets was buying, for example, Goldman bought insurance from AIG through credit default swaps. But unlike regular insurance, AIG wasn't required to put any capital reserves aside. So when the insurance was triggered, no money was there. And who ended up paying the money to Goldman? The American taxpayer. The bill has a section called OTC derivatives. I'm not 100% happy with it. There are too many loopholes. But is it an improvement? Yes, it's an improvement, and these kinds of abuses should be stopped.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland Law School, director at the Center for Health and Homeland Security, former senior regulator at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. We'll take a short break here. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And welcome back as we talk about what has happened in the financial area. The House passed a major overhaul of the nation's financial regulations on Friday that will now go to the Senate, and we'll see what happens there. Here's an email for our guest, Philip Swagel. He's a professor at Georgetown University School of Business. Travis Plunkett, he's with the Consumer Federation of America. And Michael Greenberger, professor of law at the University of Maryland. Here's an email from Josh, who's in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He says, you and your guests keep calling this legislation the most sweeping overhaul of our financial system since the 1930s, I would argue the repeal of Glass-Steagall provisions changed the landscape far more than the legislation currently under consideration. In fact, I would argue the legislation currently under consideration would bring very little change. Your reaction?
Well, I think the caller makes a very good point. When we say the most sweeping, it's the most sweeping pro-regulatory law since the Great Depression. And the caller is quite right. The repeal of Glass-Steagall and statutes that's not as well known, but I think had a bigger impact, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which deregulated swaps transactions, which led to the meltdown had very, very big impact. Look, this law is not the law that I would like to see. A lot of reformers wanted to see, but it is a net plus. There's plenty in it that will provide protections for the American public. I think reflected by Professor Schwagel's point of view that the banks aren't happy with it indicates that it pinches. It's got loopholes in it. It's not as well crafted as many of us would like. It preempts a lot of state law. But there's a lot here to be supportive of. And I think for those of us who are lobbying for greater reform, we have a job in the Senate. And I think more people are coming to the table to try and make this a better law.
Michael, I know that you were part of that lobbying effort by progressive groups to help get the House to pass this. What about the other side, Philip Schwagel, who was lobbying against all of this legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I think of myself as speaking on behalf of or caring about consumers who have less access to credit as a result of some of the so-called reforms here. That to me, that's the big concern is what's going to happen to people's access to credit. And then the second part is what's going to happen in the event of another financial crisis. And one thing that's in the bill is essentially a permanent TARP. So if there's another firm that fails, the government can go in and use public money to support a firm, to change contracts, to do whatever they want without going back to the Congress. And so I look at that part as a really worrisome part of the legislation.
Travis Plunkett.
Well, the House of Representatives leaders who put this package together have pointed out repeatedly that the so-called permanent TARP fund is funded by the banks, funded by the largest entities themselves, pre-funded in advance in case there is a problem with their solvency. So to call it a TARP implies that taxpayers are on the hook, and the House leaders behind this proposal have pointed out that that's not the case.
What about that, Philip?
So essentially the proposal is to say the banks that didn't make mistakes, that did it right, did it carefully, have to pay for the failures of the banks that did make mistakes and for the failure of the regulators who didn't catch them. So, we're starting this day by saying, why aren't banks lending? Well, you have the act saying, hey, banks, give us your resources, give us your capital, because we're gonna keep it so the government can spend it when they want to.
But at the same time, I hear all of you saying the banks are doing really quite well, certainly well enough to pay back what they need to in order to avoid government regulation. Why wouldn't a fund established by the banks themselves be an appropriate way to maybe head off another problem?
Well, I would say two things. One is that the banks are not avoiding government regulation. Though banking is among the most heavily regulated industries, not quite healthcare, but close. And again, you have to look at what happens when you take away capital from a bank. A bank uses capital to make loans. That's how banks make money. That's what we want them to do. When you pre-fund this fund, you're taking away the capital from the strong, the healthy banks. They're going to do less of it.
Travis Plunkett, described the lobbying efforts for the legislation and against the legislation.
Certainly. On the pro side, you've got pretty much all business, major business trade associations aligned against the legislation. It's not just the financial services industry, for example, it's the Chamber of Commerce, who have spent several million dollars opposing it. And then you've got all parties, all major players in the financial services industry, insurance companies, banks, small banks, and a variety of other trades within the banking and financial services industry. Against it, we've got kind of a scrappy, underfunded public interest coalition of civil rights groups, unions, consumer groups, and a variety of other public interest organizations. Very few full-time people are able to work on this legislation on the public interest side, and we found ourselves vastly outgunned in terms of getting to members of Congress and explaining to them where we think they are hearing bad information.
What about the White House? How actively did the White House participate, Michael Greenberger?
Well, I think the White House was extremely disappointing in helping with the reforms in this regard. I know that there were two major loopholes that came out of the Treasury Department in the regulation of the over-the-counter derivatives situation, and we found ourselves constantly having to present counter-arguments to the Department of Treasury, who was pushing for less regulation rather than more regulation in the OTC derivatives area. Now, that wasn't uniform. The head of the CFTC, Gary Gensler, was very aggressive in being helpful. But frankly, this was akin to passing the Securities Acts of 33 and 34, some of the great regulatory measures that came out of the New Deal, and having Franklin Delano Roosevelt arguing with the banks, who he called economic royalists at the time. I think it is very sad that President Obama is in with his hat in his hand today, pleading with the banks to please do something.
Is that how you see it?
I absolutely see
it
that way.
Do you see it the same way, Travis?
Well, I'm hoping that he's going to read them the Riot Act and say, you have an obligation here not just to lend, but also to help us erect a new system of regulation that will protect Americans in the future. Unfortunately, some of the press coverage has indicated that he may just be asking for help as opposed to telling them that it really is their obligation as Americans, as American businesses, to help us in regulation and not fight it.
To what extent do you believe that this House-passed regulation legislation is really going to help consumers, or are there too many loopholes?
Well, as you've heard, there are a lot of loopholes.
Yeah.
But overall, it's comprehensive. It deals with the major factors that led to the economic crisis that we're all coping with. It's a good piece of legislation. People like me, our job is to focus on the loopholes. We've seen the loopholes, such as for derivatives, over the past 15 years, lead to huge problems. So we are concerned, but it's important to note credit rating agencies, hedge funds, derivatives, consumer protection, all of these major issues are dealt with in the legislation, and it's a major step forward.
But there are also major exemptions, are there not? For example, real estate, is that not exempt here, Philip Swagel?
Yeah, and there's certain activities that are exempt, and certain types of users of derivatives, for example, are exempt as well.
But why would the real estate industry be exempt from this?
They've argued that in their capacity as realtors and in terms of helping people buy homes, they shouldn't be covered by a financial protection agency. If they get involved in offering loans under the language in the bill, they would be covered. One of the biggest loopholes we're concerned about relates to auto dealers. They don't have to be overseen by this agency. So listen to this, Diane. If a auto company offers a loan to somebody, they're covered. If an auto finance company offers a loan, they're covered. If a bank or a credit union offers a loan, they're covered. But the dealer who makes a great deal of money selling these loans, they are the vehicle, so to speak, for selling these loans, wouldn't be overseen by this agency. There's really no good reason to do that other than the auto dealers have a lot of power in Congress.
Philip Swagel.
Right. So I agree that it's interesting that there are all these loopholes, and I don't understand why the Congress and the president have come to this point. I would say that the other end might be worrisome as well. I mean, do we really want a new agency getting into the business of auto dealers and, you know, every sort of drugstore, every single business that has some financial activity under some, you know, interpretation of this new regulation? I don't know. And it really comes down to, how good will this new regulator be? We've seen over the last couple of years the regulators have failed. The regulators didn't do a great job in many cases. And I just worry that we're putting too much trust in a new regulator.
And what about the role of the Fed and how the Federal Reserve itself might indeed find itself with new regulations, Michael Greenberger?
Well, the Fed is given an awful lot of authority under this statute. They are the ones who are the, quote, systemic regulators. They're supposed to look out over the economy, see bubbles, and apply new restrictions on corporations who are, poorly capitalized, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a lot of people believe the Fed did not do a very good job from up until September of 2008 and did not recognize bubbles that many other people were recognizing. So they're concerned about the Fed having all this power. But in waging that battle, the Fed won. But getting back to the point of whether this is protective, the Fed certainly now is given the tools to prevent the kind of collapse that we saw in the fall of 2008. And I say, on balance, I'm not thrilled with this legislation, but it is a significant improvement over the status quo.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor of law at the University of Maryland, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Tom, who's in Durham, New Hampshire. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'd just like to make a couple of quick comments here. First of all, I'm a violinist. I'm composing an ode to the poor bankers as we speak. secondly, yesterday on this week, Eric Cantor, representing the Republicans, was asked about the number of lobbyists that they pulled together in lieu of this regulation and what was discussed. And one of the things he brought up was what you were talking earlier about the permanent TARP fund, and that's how he put it. Permanent TARP, meaning the taxpayers pay this. The Republicans, once again, have no regard for the facts. This is going to be paid for by the companies that can't fail, right? The ones that are too big to fail. And for it to be represented in any other way is just another obstructionist move. And another reason why the banks aren't lending is because 90% of them are Republicans, and they want to see this administration fail.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Permanent TARP fund, is that a phrase that is less than truthful?
I believe it's less than truthful. I think when we're assessing blame here, we've got to remember that not a single Republican voted for this legislation. 27 Democrats voted against it. If it weren't for the Democratic Party, and if it weren't for Barney Frank, who led this battle, who I've been very critical of, but he got out a very good bill, and in the end, he listened to the unions, consumer groups, this would not have happened. With regard to the TARP fund, that it is been said in among the panelists that the money is bank money that will be used. Now, again, why should the banks have to contribute to this? Because if it weren't for the American taxpayer, the banks wouldn't be here today. This is one of the small price they have to pay for their success while everybody else is failing.
We all know how important the use of language is. Mm-hmm. Permanent TARP fund suggests taxpayer money, when in fact it's the banks themselves who are putting this money forward. Why are you describing this as a permanent TARP fund?
Okay, there are two reasons. The one is that, as with the TARP, the legislation allows the government, the executive branch, to put money into a failing institution. And the problem with that is it goes right to the heart of the too-big-to-fail idea, right? If there's certainty at the end, if an institution that makes risky activities and goes off track and fails, if they know they're going into bankruptcy and there's no bailout at the end, then at the beginning, their behavior will change. Now, having a permanent fund that the government can use goes exactly against that and perpetuates the idea of too big to fail. So that's why this is a permanent TARP. Now, who funds it? Well, the idea is that it comes from the banks. And as I said before, you're penalizing the wrong ones. You're penalizing the saints to pay for the sins of the sinners. I think we all understand what happens with these government funds. The government does not do a good job of running insurance funds.
However, earlier you said it was taxpayer money.
Absolutely. So there are two ways to keep in mind that this is taxpayer money. When the money goes from the banks to the government, where are the banks getting that money? It's not from outer space. This is taxpayer money just coming into the government in a different way. That's number one. And then number two is that when this fund inevitably is not large enough.
I don't get this.
Well, so where do banks make their money? Banks make their profits from consumers, from businesses, from all of us. There's no magic source of resources that banks have.
But it's their profit that is being used to put forward. So I don't see that as government taxpayer money, and I think we need to be clear about the use of language.
No, with respect, I disagree. If I say to you, you have to fund something, well, you know, where will WAMU get the money? Well, WAMU will take it out of funds that their supporters provide. And so ultimately, the supporters of WAMU would be funding this fund.
It's a very different situation, methinks, with a nonprofit such as WAMU. Philip Swagley is professor at the Georgetown University School of Business. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, by the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
American workers are shortchanged on vacation days, sick leave, and benefits compared to their counterparts in other nations. The case for improving work life in the U.S. and around the world, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back talking about new regulations just passed by the House. Of course, it all has to go to the Senate, does it not, Michael?
Absolutely. And this bill passed with every Republican voting against it and 27 Democrats. It was a very close vote in the House. And as a practical matter, I think people understand today you need 60 votes to get something out of the Senate. So it's going to be a very, very hard battle. The good news I have in that regard is my observation is every week that passed since the beginning of October, more and more reform-minded groups, reform-minded citizens have come to the table. And our constituency built dramatically up until the day of passage. And we were able to get a lot of very good concessions. The bill would have been a lot weaker had not the unions, the consumer groups, civil rights groups, environmental groups, and just concerned citizens come to the table. And I might also add, one of the last-minute travesties of this bill was a lot of preemption of state consumer laws and state public citizen actions that can be brought. And I know that that has roused state attorney generals out of their seats. This week, we're conducting meetings with state attorney generals And we expect them to join this battle on the Senate side.
All right, let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a question on within this bill. With a goodly amount of people who have lost their homes, they're unemployed, they've lost their ability to borrow. And the only place left to turn is to the credit now check places and automotive dealers who do their own loans up to 40%. There's going to be, in the next few years, a good section of our population that cannot borrow money from conventional loan institutions.
Travis Plunkett, do you agree?
Well, right now, credit is harder to get than it was 3 years ago. In some cases, that's a good thing. I think a lot of us are aware of, for example, credit card loans. We didn't ask that our credit lines be doubled or tripled, and they were. At that point, the credit card issuers were encouraging us to be reckless. In other cases, there are people who have a genuine need and are creditworthy, and their only option in some cases, as the caller mentions, are these very high-cost options. In general, the people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum are the ones who suffer the most when there is a regulatory collapse. I would only point out that the major factor here is poor regulation, not over-regulation. Had we had some common sense regulation in place, we wouldn't have had a lot of the bad loans that we had. We wouldn't have had the collapse in the housing market in all likelihood. And we would have had more stability, which means that the very people the caller is concerned about would have had better access to credit right now.
Here's an interesting email from Rebecca in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. She says, how has our government turned a blind eye and allowed the American taxpayer to be gouged, swindled, and abused all these years? And maybe the better question is why the people have been silent while we have been beaten down, Michael?
Well, that's an excellent question. There was a predominant theory that began in the 70s. It's proposed by the so-called Chicago School of Economics, that markets regulate themselves, and when the government tries to do something, it's ham-handed and confuses things. And I think that theory now is dying a well-deserved death. And there is more understanding that government can't run the economy, but it's got to police the economy.
And speaking of understanding, what is your view of the phrase permanent TARP fund?
I just do not agree with it. I mean, essentially, the only beneficiary out of the TARP thing were the banks. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Citicorp are doing quite well. They're paying all this money back. I think the American citizen does not view, the average American citizen does not view him or herself as doing well. This is the one of the few minimal obligations they have, which is to set up a rescue fund for the next crisis. And I would also say, you know, one of the terrible mistakes that was made with the TARP funds, and we made it twice because we had to extend the second tranche under President Obama, was not insisting as a condition of getting this money that they extend credit and refinance mortgages.
All right, to Madison, Connecticut. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks. My question goes right to the heart of this thing. The banks are doing really well, and we hear they're doing really well in Wall Street. Well, guess what? Our currency was devalued starting in January, 30%. Nobody seems to care because nobody buys anything offshore but me, apparently. So if you had cash, you lost 30% of your value. Of course the banks do well on Wall Street. They're riding this upsurge in the trading and the growth and the value of the market in U.S. dollars. And so it's sort of free money, pennies from heaven yet again for the banks, and nobody talks about it.
Philip Swagel.
I guess I'd say two things. So one, there has been a weakening of the dollar. Right in the fall, there was a flight to safety of global investors to the safety of U.S. dollars and U.S. Treasury securities. That's unwinding. So that has accounted for the weakness of the dollar. You know, look, we have a big trade deficit. That suggests the dollar will be weaker going forward. You know, the other thing I would say is that it's just preposterous to say that the only beneficiary of the TARP were the banks. President Obama gave a speech last week at Brookings where he said exactly the opposite, that he didn't like to do it, he didn't like the TARP, but he had to do it to save the economy, to save the financial system. So that suggests that all of us were beneficiaries. None of us liked doing it. But if the financial system melts down, it's not just the banks who suffer. Unfortunately, it's all of us, and that's the situation that we were all faced with last fall.
All right, to Burlington, North Carolina. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. My question is, with all the frustration we've had over what the banks have been doing with credit cards recently, why not force the banks to give up the credit card business and sell it off?
Travis.
Well, if credit card lending is done right, it can be beneficial. I've been one of the strongest advocates over the last decade in cleaning up business practices in the credit card industry. But I really do recognize that wisely given, credit card loans are important and helpful. The credit card is a major convenience for a lot of us. And if we can depend on the terms, if a deal is a deal, if it doesn't change suddenly, I think moving forward, this new law is going to make sure that credit card loans are fairer and more transparent.
But why do you have to have them as part of the banks? Why can't the credit card industry be totally separate from the banks, Michael?
Well, I think this is a larger question, and it goes to the Glass-Steagall question. It used to be if banks brought in deposits and the deposits were insured, they couldn't make risky investment decisions. We abandoned that with the repeal of Glass-Steagall. I think the one weapon President Obama and the Congress have over the banks is the reimposition of Glass-Steagall. And I do believe very shortly you're going to see a bipartisan, there will be Republicans supporting this, to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And if the American consumers want to bring the banks under control, one hidden thing here is the banks get deposits. The deposits are insured, so they get more deposits. And the one thing we haven't talked about is they take that money and they invest it for themselves. That's called proprietary trading. They have all these slick computer models. When you hear that Goldman makes $3 billion, it's not from making loans to the public. It's for trading their own deposits. So the hidden secret here, I think, for the listeners who are upset about the banks is tell your members of Congress, reinstate Glass-Steagall.
What do you think, Philip Swagel?
You know, look, I agree that banks got into activities that were risky and not well supervised. But I look at Bear Stearns, Lehman, and maybe Citi. Those are institutions that got into trouble. Bear and Lehman did not, you know, we're not Glass-Steagall firms, right? They didn't go into universal banking with the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Citi did. But then you have Goldman didn't. J.P. Morgan Chase did. Goldman and J.P. Morgan did well. So I agree with the big picture here that banks getting into risky activities is something that has to be looked at very closely. And so I want to make sure everyone understands the big picture is that we need change. I just don't think it's Glass-Steagall in particular that is the problem.
Here's an email from Dave in Bel Air, Maryland, who says, I too am distressed the Obama administration has been negligent in pushing the regulation. Who is responsible for the weak stance? Volcker is apparently just a figurehead. Is Geithner the problem?
Well, I would encourage readers who believe are worried about the direction of the Obama administration to read an article by Matt Taibbi in this month's Rolling Stone, which is reaching an iconic status, which unfortunately President Obama, shortly after he was elected, hired a bunch of people who were followers of Bob Rubin, who was a Goldman CEO and then a top person at Citicorp. And a lot of people are now staffing the administration who have worked in banks and are very sympathetic to banks. I will tell you, the politics of this for the administration is horrific. The Republicans are very clever. They're screaming at the banks, and the American people like to hear that, but they're voting with the banks, for example, voting against this House bill. The Obama administration, unfortunately, is being viewed as sympathetic to the banks, yet trying to get some of these minimal regulatory procedures in. It is absolutely clear to me the reason the president was so hostile to the banks on 60 Minutes and is being tough with the banks today is the American public is coming through loud and clear, and he would be better served by bringing in honest brokers in his administration rather than people who have been so closely aligned with banks.
Philip. Look, I disagree at times with the administration, but they have a superb economic team. And when I disagree with them, I understand they're doing their best in trying to improve the country as best as they can. And we can disagree on the means, but I have no doubt that they have the same goal that I do.
Travis Plunkett.
Well, the Obama team put together the broad outlines of this comprehensive package. So we have to also offer some positive words here. The comprehensive nature of this package that we're talking about, that was initially proposed by the president. The strong words on the need for additional consumer protection, that was the president. On some of the details, especially on derivatives and other things, we'd like to see them work harder.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Hi there, Nick. You're on the air. Nick, are you there? Okay, I guess not. Let's go to Indianapolis. Aaron, good morning to you.
Good morning. I was wondering if this idea that the banks would be providing future funding for their own calamities, and indeed calamities for the entire economy, isn't that similar to the idea of the IMF?
Michael Greenberger.
Well, I'm not quite sure of the import of that question, but I think something implicit in it is the one thing that was not followed either by the administration here or Congress is something that both Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan are advocating, which is the banks cannot be these huge monsters that become too big to fail. And there were proposals to restrict the size of banks, and I think you're going to see those restrictions gain currency in the future when you have two variant ideologies such as Volcker's and Greenspan agreeing to it.
Michael Greenberger at the University of Maryland Law School, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Dennis, who's in Tacoma, Washington. Good morning to you, sir. Go right ahead.
Morning. I have a comment, and then I have a question.
Sure.
My comment is the whole reason for the meltdown that I can see with this economic problem is the fact that we have no term limits on these senators and representatives in our great representative republic. And these are the guys that are making the backdoor deals about getting their campaign funds from all the lobbyists that they talk to.
All right, sir. Well, that's the subject of a whole nother program. So go ahead with your question, please.
Well, my question on the monetary factors of what these people are trying to do now is, it's just that the fox is in the hen house. What good does it do to keep talking about it? They got the same people, and they're going to do the same things to cover their butts. And
what do you think, Michael?
Well, I just think people who are upset with the direction of the way things are going have to make their voice heard. It's no good to sit in your home and
yep.
stew over it.
Yep.
And I can assure you that if you call your member of Congress or you email them or you fax them, your voice is heard. Those things are counted.
And finally, email this from Jay, who says, my question is, how will the proposed regulations likely affect bank profits? Will they do anything to increase long-term stability over short-term gains?
Right. I hope so. I mean, I hope some of the increased regulation and some of the new focus on capital charges will lead banks to undertake less risky activities. And that would hopefully improve stability and be good for all of us. And like I said before, the balance is between stability and innovation that's, you know, potentially good.
Is hope the key word here, Travis?
We're never going to know until the law is implemented how it will work. But I share the same hope. Short-term profit-seeking was a major motive for the huge problems we've experienced. We do need more long-term stability. The broad outlines of this legislation will provide it. It won't be as lucrative quarter in and quarter out, but long-term, it could be better for the economy and for Americans.
Michael.
I think bankers will have one less home to buy because they'll have to put some of that money into capital. to be preserve their institutions. There's profits and there's excessive profits. Some of those excessive profits have to be converted into capitalizing so that the taxpayer isn't rescuing
but
the banks.
How optimistic are you about the Senate?
Look, I'm not going to joke about it. It's a very serious problem, and a lot of work needs to be done. I am optimistic because I see the forces for reform are growing and the influence of the bank lobbyists is lessening.
Travis, do you believe that?
Well, it's looking hard. I have to tell you the truth. The Senate is going to be a struggle. But if senators hear from their constituents, as Dr. Greenberger was talking about, they will move the right direction.
Travis Plunkett, he's legislative director for the Consumer Federation of America. Michael Greenberger is professor of law at the University of Maryland. Philip Swagel is professor at the Georgetown University School of Business. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.